Good day, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. Every week, we're getting a few more people live. This is really fantastic. Pretty soon, it's going to be back up to BC before COVID. So it's good to see everyone. It's really good to see Dr. Ross. He's with us this morning, and he's going to be with us all through June and most of July. He's got a date where he's heading out somewhere late July. I think July 23rd he won't be with us, but he will be with us until that point. So good to have you back. Hope you tell us about your travels when you come up. Thank you very much, Mark and Val Durham, for the treats back there. And we want to start, yes, thank you. We want to start doing a treat sign-up list like we used to. So is there anybody that would volunteer to bring treats next week? Nancy, great, okay. Thank you, bless you for that. And we'll start doing a treat sign-up list like we used to do. I'm still looking for somebody to do a book table like we used to have. Yes, we need a book table. We miss Colleen. Maybe you can help us organize that somehow. Okay, I have a real important story to tell. What's that? Okay, so three guys are fishing, right, when an angel appears. The first guy says, I've been suffering from back pain for years. Can you help me? The angel touches the man's back and he feels instant relief. Yep. The second guy points to his thick glasses, I can relate, and begs for a cure for his poor eyesight. The angel grabs the glasses, throws them away, and instantly the man has 20/20 vision. The angel turns to the third fellow. He instantly recoils and he screams, "Don't touch me, I'm on disability." You know, you think about it, you wonder if some of the people in the Bible, the Lord always asked, didn't he? Jesus always said, do you want to be healed? We read that and we think, well, duh. But you know what? There was a living to be made from it. So it was a question that he had to ask. Anyway, let's say a prayer. Heavenly Father, we're so grateful for this class. We're so grateful that Dr. Hugh Ross is with us. We thank you for what this class has meant to each one of us, Lord, for all the years that we've been coming. We're so grateful to be part of a class like this. We ask your blessing on Dr. Ross as he teaches us today and each one of us as we go our way today. Thank you so much, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Please welcome Dr. Ross.
Hey, well, thank you. And we're launching a series on the fine-tuning argument. I'm framing it in the context of the fine-tuning to bring about the redemption of billions of human beings. Now, the fine-tuning series I'm going to be presenting is basically from an astronomical and physical perspective. And Tim, I really love what you said last week. And Ross, because you basically focused on fine-tuning in the context of the life sciences. I mean, that's a completely different fine-tuning argument. By the way, I thought the visuals that were presented last week were really phenomenal. So good job. And you know, last week, I was in Vancouver, British Columbia. That's the city in which I was raised. And it was a downtown church that invited me to come and speak. And you know, if you've ever been to Vancouver, the downtown area is amazing. It's surrounded by water. There's this incredible park there. It's more than a square mile that anyone in downtown can walk to and enjoy. There's four beaches you can get to from downtown. You can get fish and crabs just by going to the wharfs there. And you can actually fly in on seaplanes right into that area. And this church is smack in the middle of downtown, surrounded by buildings that are, you know, 30 to 60 stories high. And many people have offered this church a lot of money for their land. They said, why don't you go to the suburbs? They said, no, we think our mission is to reach the people downtown. And what I love about this church, they have a lot of their services at lunchtime, Monday through Friday, because there's all these people that come in to the downtown area for work, and then they leave right afterwards. And it's like, if we're going to reach the unbelievers in downtown Vancouver, we got to get them while they're there. And so they have these lunch hour meetings. The other thing I love about the church, they have a policy that every message is ended with a Q&A time. You know, the same model we have here in Paradoxes. There's teaching followed by Q&A, where it's open mic discussion, a debate whatsoever. And something I was able to share with the pastoral team there, that every church I've been in, where they close their message with an open mic Q&A, is a church that grows through adult converts. And I didn't know this when I got into the church, but they have 7 campuses, and 2 of them are in downtown because the building they have is not big enough for all the people who want to come. So 3 blocks away, they rent a big movie theater, and people come in there. And everything is live streamed to the 7 campuses. And one of the campuses is targeting the snowbirds from Canada in Arizona. So they, one of their churches is right there in Phoenix, and one of them is in Hong Kong, because the new nickname for Vancouver is Hongcouver, because the city is now about 80% Asian. So they decided to reach out to the... And so they're basically saying, where are all the people in Vancouver going to? Phoenix, Hong Kong, they have congregations right there as well. And they put Kathy and me in a hotel directly across the street from the church. And this is a photo of the hotel. I thought you'd enjoy the name of the hotel. And here's a photo of me and Kathy with the senior pastor with the hotel in the background. And the senior pastor actually knows the owner of the hotel. And so it's a very nice hotel that they says, I'll give a cut rate for all the guests that you have. So we were able to stay there for pennies of what other people have to pay. And it's not a small hotel. This is what the hotel looks like vertically. It's 60 stories high. So, and this is typical of downtown Vancouver. So for example, this building, the first 20 floors is a hotel. Floors 20 through to 60 are condominiums. And so there's really a very dense population of people that live in downtown Vancouver. And so literally, there's 100,000 people that are within walking distance of the 2 downtown churches that they have. People actually live there, and they come there. I got an opportunity just to share my story when I was there the first time, because they were intrigued, hey, you were raised in Vancouver, how did you come to Christ? And I said, well, this is downtown Vancouver. I lived a few miles away from downtown Vancouver. And at that time, it was the slums of Vancouver. And there were no Christians in our neighborhood. And I did get to speak in Vancouver's Bible Belt. It's a town called Abbotsford, which is 60 miles east of Vancouver. Never heard of Abbotsford growing up, but that's one of the problems of Canada. The Christians, unlike here in the United States, tend to gather and form their own little Christian suburbs. And so like Vancouver, less than 1% Christian, Abbotsford, over 90% Christian. What I loved about the United States when I came here is realizing the Christians purposely spread themselves out throughout the population. And it's a great way for evangelism to operate. And that's a missing ingredient to a large degree in Canada, but this church is an exception. So I was able to share with the people there how I was raised just a few miles from the church and didn't know any Christians, but I got into astronomy when I was 7 years of age. And through my studies of astronomy, realized that the universe had to have a beginning and went on a search for the cosmic beginner. People said, well, how did you find the cosmic beginner? I had no idea where to look, but But I figured, well, you know, Immanuel Kant is called the father of cosmology. I'll read his books. So I read the Critique of Pure Reason and said, you know, this has a lot of missing features here. And looked at René Descartes, and I thought, maybe I need to look at the religions of the world. So I began to look at Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. And, you know, being raised in Vancouver and going to a high school near the port of Vancouver, we had people from all different parts of the world. I was the lone, you know, British, I mean, I'm from a Scottish ancestry. I think I was the only Scot person. And that's what's interesting. You know, Canada has more Scottish people than Scotland has. But the high school I went to, I was the only one that was literally from the British United Kingdom. So, but looked at the different religions, and as I was sharing with our pastor this morning, the message this morning was on the Trinity and how the Trinity was a major factor in my coming to faith in Jesus Christ. And the context was, I was taking this course at the University of British Columbia on complex variables. It's basically a mathematics course where you're trying to do mathematics in the context of 4, 5, 6, 1 million dimensions of space and time, and it's transdimensional mathematics. And this is what led me to realize, you know, I've been looking at all these different religions of the world. Every one of them, except Christianity, communicates the doctrine of God as if God is constrained to 4 space-time dimensions. The heaven and the hell of these other religions is also something that can be comprehended from 4 space-time dimensions. And I saw that as evidence. These books don't come from a being beyond the universe. They show the limitations of human visualization. But when I picked up a Gideon Bible, it was given to me in Vancouver's public schools, and began to go through it, I said, this book stands apart. It's got teachings in it that can't be comprehended within length, width, height, and time. The Trinity is an example. The simultaneity of human free will and divine predestination is an example. And for those of you who haven't been part of this class for 47 years, we began the class and said, we're going to start this class teaching about the paradoxes in the Bible. And a paradox is something that looks contradictory, but can be resolved if you look at it from a big enough perspective. So that was the launch of this class. And we spent a time looking at the doctrine of the Trinity, free will and predestination, what the Bible says about heaven and hell, and that kind of name stuck. So anyway, let me jump into where we're going with this series on fine-tuning and design. And what I mentioned when we launched this series 2 weeks ago is that if you really want to reach people who are not followers of Jesus Christ, have not been part of the Christian community, and are not familiar with what the Bible teaches, you first have to deal with all their presumed rebuttals to the fine-tuning argument. I mean, I used to make the mistake of reaching out to unbelievers and saying, here are all the positive evidences for fine-tuning. But in the back of their minds, they were saying, yeah, but there's a rebuttal to that. There's a rebuttal to that. There's a rebuttal to that. And so what I'm now doing when I speak on fine-tuning is I deal with the rebuttals up front so that they say, aha, that rebuttal is not as effective as I thought it was. Now they're open to hearing the positive evidences. But if you don't deal with their presumed rebuttals up front, it makes it difficult for them to hear and receive the positive evidences. So that's what we've been doing. And I've been writing about fine-tuning literally for over 30 years. As I mentioned, we launched the series. I've now put out 7 full-length books on fine-tuning, the design evidence for the God of the Bible. But these are the 5 predominant rebuttals to the cosmic fine-tuning argument. And so when we launched the class 2 weeks ago, I talked about the puddle analogy, how you get these people saying, hey, this universe isn't fine-tuned for us human beings. The fallacy here is This fine-tuning is equivalent to water in a puddle saying, hey, look at this puddle. It's perfectly fine-tuned for me. But as we pointed out, life is not like liquid water. Liquid water will fill and fit any puddle it finds itself in, but life cannot fit into any old universe. So the fallacy and the multiverse, which is the idea that the universe isn't fine-tuned by God. They do admit it's fine-tuned. They say we see incredible fine-tuning, but we don't need a God with a mind to explain the fine-tuning. All we need is an infinite number of universes. And as I explained, you really need an infinite number of an infinite number of universes. You need infinity to the infinity and power, and you also need to presume every universe that exists is distinct, is different from every other universe. And if you've got an infinity of universes, it means any set of characteristics inevitably will appear. And the argument is, we just happen to be in the lucky universe of the infinite number of different universes that has all the characteristics that makes our existence possible. And an obvious problem there is, who says all the universes have to be different from one another? Maybe they're not. But as we explain, the real problem with the multiverse argument, it explains everything. An argument that explains everything explains nothing. That's a direct quote from the famous theoretical physicist Leonard Susskind. And he never gave an analogy. I gave you one last week, basically saying, if you're going to appeal to an infinite number of universes, they're all different from one another, so that by pure chance, we have all these design features. You can use the same argument to explain away every human design. And therefore, you'd be concluding, we humans didn't write research papers. We humans didn't build buildings. The multiverse did it. And so if you're going to appeal to the multiverse to explain away God's design, it explains away every single human achievement by the same token. And the bottom line is, and I said this to audiences way back in the 1980s, any time an unbeliever appeals to any kind of infinity to dodge the evidence, scientific evidence for God, they've got nothing. Whenever you appeal to infinity, it'll explain everything. An argument that explains everything explains nothing. Okay, that's where we left off 2 weeks ago. I want to cover the other three rebuttals today. And people have asked me, are there other rebuttals? Yes, there are other rebuttals, but unbelievers themselves realize they don't work. These are the five that you'll see on the internet, in articles, and what's interesting, these are now appearing in peer-reviewed scientific journals. And what's interesting, too, is these scientific papers are basically exposing why these are bad arguments to eliminate the evidence for fine-tuning. Life as we don't know it. And, you know, I remember getting this from Carl Sagan when he was teaching a class at the University of Toronto to the graduate astronomy department there. And he says, well, you know, people who claim that God's behind all the design of the universe, they're making the assumption that life elsewhere has to be life as we know it. What about life as we don't know it? Now, if you look at the seven books I've written, the one presumption I'm making, if there's life elsewhere in the universe, that life must be carbon-based. And, you know, this is something that people like Carl Sagan understood. This is not a debate about whether other intelligent beings have three eyes instead of two eyes, or two ears instead of four ears. Really, when we're talking about life as we know it, we're talking about carbon-based life. But the rebuttal is, well, what about life as we don't know it? What about life that's built upon some other element in the periodic table besides carbon? And if you're a fan of Star Trek, there's a famous episode of Star Trek where they go to a planet and they find silicon-based life there. So is silicon-based life an option for life? Well, in order to have life, it's important that the foundational element be able to bond with itself. And so like when it comes to lipids and the proteins and DNA and RNA, it's filled with these carbon-carbon bonds, where a single carbon atom, you know, you talked about this last week, and how you get these long chains of carbon atoms that join together, and on that basis you can get really complex molecules. Not only are they complex, they're stable. But the problem with silicon is that it doesn't form silicon-silicon chains, because it really likes oxygen a whole lot more than it likes another fellow silicon atom. And so you get silicon oxide. What's silicon oxide? Sand. And so, again, I appreciate that Star Trek episode, because the silicon base life was basically a huge ball of sand. But they were claiming that the sand molecules could be made complex enough. They really can't. You get silicon joining to oxygen, and you're getting silicon dioxide, which is basically sand, and it's not going to bind with other molecules. The other problem with silicon is that when you do have silicon binding with another atom, whether it be oxygen or some other atom, it's unstable in water. And so now you've got to conceive of silicon-based life without water. You've got to have some other solvent. The problem is there really is no other solvent that can do everything that water can do. That's a whole nother talk. Why life has to be able to be based on the water. And the other problem with silicon is that either the bonding is way too stable, which means it can't share information. Again, thinking about the talk we had last week, is that you got DNA, which stores the information. RNA is able to trade or transfer the information from the DNA to the constructing of the proteins. For DNA, it's essential that the chemical bonds be stable for a long period of time. But for RNA, it's important that the bonds not be stable. And so for life to exist, you need a base element that has the just right stability. It can't be too stable. It can't be too unstable. And that's the problem with silicon, is that you don't have the stability features necessary to make anything close to proteins, DNA, or RNA. And particularly, you can't make long chains of amino acids to make any kind of functional protein. The assembly of these silicon-based amino acids are very short, and they don't last long. So if there's now a consensus in the scientific literature, and by the way, this was established more than 40 years ago, silicon is not an option for life. There's lots of it, not as much as oxygen, but there's a fair amount of silicon. Our planet Earth has a lot of silicon on it, about half as much as it has of oxygen. And so you've got the required abundance. But the problem is you don't have the complexity of bonding. You don't have the double and triple bonds that you get with carbon, and you don't have the necessary stability, and it doesn't work well in water. And so about 40 years ago, they said silicon's off the table, in spite of what you see in Star Trek. It's not an option. They said, well, maybe we need to look at other elements. So they looked at boron. You know, boron has got a lot of similarities with carbon. They also looked at arsenic. Arsenic has a lot of similarities with carbon. And matter of fact, what can happen in your body is that you can consume too much boron, and the boron begins to substitute for the carbon, and now you wind up having health issues. Same thing can happen with arsenic. You've probably read some of those novels like Arsenic and Lace. Only takes a little bit of arsenic before your body begins substituting too much of it for the carbon. And one of the problems with boron and arsenic is that it's 5,000 times less abundant than carbon. There's simply not enough boron around to have boron-based life. There's not enough arsenic around to have arsenic-based life. And both boron and arsenic are toxic when they're present in abundance. By the way, boron is a life essential element. So is arsenic a life essential element? Some of your proteins have arsenic in them. So you need to make sure you're getting a decent amount of arsenic in your diet. However, you only need a really tiny, tiny amount. Too little, you'll die. Too much, you'll die. But we live on a planet where the arsenic in our food is at the just right level, so we're getting what we need. Same thing's true of boron. It's one of these what we call a vital poison. Too little in your diet, you'll die. Too much in your diet, you'll also die. It has to be at a fine-tuned level. But the fact that it's 5,000 times less abundant, and the fact that it's toxic when present in your body in any significant amount, is a problem. Now, what about carbon? Can you consume too much carbon? You really can't. Yeah, you can pull more carbon in your body than you need, but you can also shed that carbon, you're fine. No one's going to die of carbon poisoning, but you will die of boron poisoning. You will die of arsenic poisoning. Okay, the only other element in the periodic table that's ever been considered as a foundation for building a life is sulfur. And sulfur is more abundant than boron and arsenic. However, the problem with sulfur is that, again, it's very difficult to get sulfur-sulfur bonds. You don't get the complexity of bonding that you need. And almost every time it bonds with a different element, it makes something that's highly acidic. You've probably heard, I don't know if you've ever heard this in chemistry, and maybe I'm dating myself, but I remember the first chemistry class I took. The professor started off with a very short poem. And it talks about this boy called Moore, Sam Moore. And Sam Moore was a boy who is a boy no more, for what he thought was H2O was H2SO4. H2SO4 being an extremely acidic acid. And so, yeah, you bring that into your body, the acidic nature of it begins to destroy life. And one of the amazing features of our planet is we live on a planet that's super underabundant in sulfur. And this is even the case with the other planets in our solar system. So I don't know how many of you ever saw that movie about the Martian, where it showed Matt Damon walking around on Mars and how he had to be rescued. And you saw him planting potatoes in this Martian soil and eating the potatoes. He fertilized it with his own excrement, but a lot of it was Martian soil. And I was watching with my sons, and I said, that can't happen on Mars. They said, Dad, just shut up. So we want to enjoy the movie. But I insist on explaining to them that the soil on Mars has 60 times as much sulfur than the soil on Earth. And therefore, there's no way you can grow potatoes on Mars. You can't grow anything on Mars because of the high sulfur content. So sulfur is not a friend for life. It's very toxic for life. On the other hand, it's also a vital poison. You need sulfur in your diet. And there are certain vegetables that you can eat are fairly high in sulfur. And the body's very good at getting rid of the sulfur it doesn't need. So again, it's difficult to kill somebody by giving them lots of sulfur. But if you have too much, it'll kill you. If you got too little, it'll kill you. It's one of those vital poisons. So boron-based life doesn't work. Arsenic-based life doesn't work. And neither does sulfur-based life work. But I remember back in 2008, I got invited to speak at the International Skeptics Society conference at Caltech. They had atheists from all over the world come and participate in a weekend conference. And I was scheduled to debate Victor Stenger at the end of the conference, but I decided to attend the whole conference. Interesting conference because they had five world-renowned atheist scientists. Four of them were physicists, all speak on why science proves there is no God. And I was really impressed with those five talks because one of the things I noticed, every one of these scientists is only focusing on the God of the Bible. They're ignoring the gods of the other religions of the world. The whole focus is on the God of the Bible. And I said, they're also extremely passionate about the non-existence of the God of the Bible. I kept thinking to myself, if they really did believe that the God of the Bible doesn't exist, they'd be treating the God of the Bible like the tooth fairy. or like the Great Pumpkin, or like Santa Claus. But the fact that they have such all this passion and the singular focus is on the God of the Bible tells me they really do believe in the God of the Bible. The problem is they don't like him. And I remember sharing that with many of the atheists in the audience after my debate. And they were saying, it's not that we despise the God of the Bible, it's that we hate his followers. And they all had stories of how they've been wounded by people who claim to be Christians. And they had a problem with forgiving. So I was able to share with them, you know, there's a verse in Matthew 7, if you will not forgive others, the creator of the universe will not forgive you. And it says, you want to know why that verse is there? Every one of us human beings has offended God to a far greater degree than any human being has ever offended us. And so when you refuse to forgive a human being, you're basically saying, I've been hurt worse than the one who came here and sacrificed his life for all of us. And that's just simply irrational. But I also pointed out, I understand how difficult it is to forgive others. We've all been hurt. We've all been wounded. And it's difficult to forgive. But the Creator who died for you is willing to give you a spirit of forgiveness when you don't have one. And it may take time, but would you be willing to allow God to do for you what you can't do for yourself, give you the power to forgive that you don't presently possess? And incidentally, that's kind of the core of the gospel. None of us can please God, but God was prepared to do for us what we can't do for ourselves, to trade our moral imperfection for his moral perfection. Anyways, I'm a little bit off base there, but to what came up in that debate I had with Victor Stenger, the atheist particle physicist, he kept saying, Hugh, you presented all this evidence for fine-tuning, but what about life as we don't know it? Now, he agreed with me, it can't be silicon-based, it can't be boron-based, it can't be arsenic or sulfur-based, but he said, what about life that doesn't need our laws of physics? What about life that doesn't need the periodic table? Wouldn't that be a realm where the fine-tuning would be really different from the fine-tuning in our universe? And I got a laugh from the assembled audience. Says, oh, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about angels. Yes, they live in a completely different realm than we do. They don't need our periodic table. They don't need our laws of physics. But guess what? Their realm is fine-tuned just like our realm is. Anything as complex as intelligent life requires fine-tuning. It's a different fine-tuning, but it's fine-tuning nonetheless. Okay, life as we don't know. Now, if you want to read more about this, about a month ago, I had a peer-reviewed paper published in a secular journal, and I drew four reviewers that reviewed my paper. One reason I submit to this journal is that they not only make my paper publicly available for free, you can read the whole paper without paying a page charge, they also make available for free all the reviewers' critique of my paper, but they also make available for free my responses to the reviewers. And the last time I published a couple of years ago, I drew three atheist reviewers. This time I drew four. They're a little bit friendlier towards me than the previous. I don't know their background. They're all anonymous. But a good chunk of the paper was focused on what about life as we don't know it. So if you want the technical details with the papers, and incidentally, I also like about this journal, they have live links to all the papers that I cite in support of my claims. So you can get that paper for free online. That's the URL to dig it up, but a faster way to find it, just put in biblical perspectives as a guide to research on life's origin and history. And you might even find if you just put biblical perspectives on the origin and history of life. So if you want to read that, you can. Interesting exercise, I submitted a paper a little under 11,000 words, but by the time I was finished dealing with all the requests from the four reviewers, the paper wound up being 14,000 words. So when you do get peer review, you often have to do a lot of extra work. But I'm grateful because they basically made the paper a lot stronger. I also appreciate the journalist said, gee, 3,000 extra words, I'm going to have to pay a higher page charge, and they cut me a break. So it was good. All right. Okay, the fourth rebuttal that's thrown out there is, what about a sample size? You're arguing that the universe is designed, but how can you make any kind of statistical argument for fine-tuning when you're dealing with a sample size of one? Now, people are promoting the multiverse will say there's a large number of universes. Matter of fact, the inflationary Big Bang creation model tells us that you get many different space-time bubbles when the universe is about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. So there's good reason scientifically to say there are other universes. But it was Albert Einstein who proved in a paper that once you get observers capable of measuring the characteristics of the universe, once observers appear in the universe, at that point, they're unable to detect the possible existence of any other universe. So there's really no scientific way to see or measure or detect the existence of another universe. The sample size for the universe is one. Now, which is why what we're going to be doing in this series, we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at the fine-tuning of the universe as a whole. But most of what you're going to be seeing is we're going to begin with the universe, and then we're going to look at smaller and smaller size scales, starting with the universe as a whole, then looking at the cosmic web, which is the first place you see structure in the universe and see the fine-tuning at that level, because the cosmic web is composed of tens of thousands of webby bubbles. So we're going to be looking at all those bubbles. Then we're going to be looking at a super galaxy cluster in which we live, the galaxy cluster in which we live, the galaxy group in which we live, our galaxy, and basically go into our galaxy and look at the local arm, the local bubble, the local fluff, down to the solar system, down to our star and planet Earth, basically making the point. We're no longer dealing with a sample size of one. We look at the cosmic web, tens of thousands of individual bubbles that make up that cosmic web. When you get down to our star, we're looking at over a trillion, trillion stars in the universe. So now we got a big sample size. And with that big sample size, we can overcome the argument, hey, when we got this many different stars to look at, this many different planets, this many different moons, now we can actually make an argument, hey, when we look at our moon, our star, our galaxy, our super galaxy cluster, we see features that are fine-tuned, and we don't see these features in the rest of the sample size that we see here. Okay, I actually have a whole talk prepared on bad designs, and I'm going to stop here, but basically make the point that when people say, hey, this fine-tuning, again, these are people who are saying, we concede there's fine-tuned designs in the universe, in life forms, in the human body. But this is not designed from the God of the Bible because the designs are not perfect. The designs are crippled. There are bad designs in the universe. Now, what you'll notice is that when the skeptic says the design can't be from God because look at all these imperfect designs, what you notice is they're always appealing to something really complicated, where we can't really see the fullness of the design. So that's one reason why they look inside the cell. I mean, what you were presenting last week, is that it's so complicated, people can see things that they say, gee, that's not a good design. And likewise, they can do that with the human body and say, look at the human backbone. It's a terrible design. Well, it's terrible if you're 7 feet tall. It's not so bad if you're 5.5 feet tall. And it's not the best possible design if you want to run a marathon. And it's not the best possible design if you're sitting in a computer all day. But it's a great design if you're having to walk, run, sit at a computer desk for a long time, be able to sleep for 8 hours. The human backbone is designed for multiple functionality. And that's the point I'm making here. Have all possible design purposes been exhaustively examined? I mean, a good example is the appendix. People said it has no function for digestion, therefore it must be an organ we inherited from some genetic mistake or a mutation from our ancestors. It's a bad design. They were not looking in the right place. The appendix does not serve any function for digestion, but it serves an important function for the human immune response system. So that's the point. Have they really looked everywhere, and maybe there's designs and purposes they haven't exhausted? The other thing is that perhaps they haven't looked at the design trade-offs. And so what I'm going to do next week is I'll look at the problem, and this has been in the published literature, people basically saying, hey, this rare earth doctrine where people conclude our earth has been supernaturally designed by God to be a great environment for us human beings. And there's a group of scientists that published a paper on what they call super habitable planets. Planets that are better than planet Earth as being a home for life and us human beings. And other papers have been published. The sun isn't optimally fine-tuned. We can conceive of a better star. We can conceive of a better moon, a better Earth. We can conceive of a better galaxy. And in all these cases, what's happened is they haven't considered the trade-off needs. Is that, yes, a bigger planet, for example, would give more habitat space for life. But there are problems with appealing to a bigger planet. Anyway, next week, we'll be talking about super habitable planets, super habitable stars, super habitable moons, and hey, it's not just in biology where people stumble over and think there's bad designs when in fact the designs are good. But when you talk about a planet, you're talking about something that astronomically is way more complex than a gas cloud, way more complex than a star. So it's not at all surprising that people have tried to say, hey, planet Earth is not a very well-designed planet. So next week we'll talk about that, Q&A, and as always, we'll take questions on any subject. It doesn't have to be the topic we talked about today, but it can be. And we'll alternate between people that are here in person and people that are participating online, but I can see we got a question from our online audience.
Okay, here we are. We already have several online questions, so as you said, we'll take turns. I'll do an online question, and if anyone here in the live audience has a question, please stand over here and I'll get you here. So Keith Wilson says, young Earth folks talk about the sizes and vast distances of objects across space, yet they deny that the speed of light can be measured, or claim that objects cannot be more than 10,000 light years distant from us. Is this a fair representation of their position?
Okay, within the young Earth creationist community, they have a variety of ways of responding to what is called the light time travel problem. The light time travel problem is the fact that we have these distant galaxies, and light travels from the galaxies to our telescope. And so they say, hey, with a velocity of light at 186,000 miles per hour, and if that galaxy is billions of light years away, that light took billions of years to reach us, and this doesn't fit within our young Earth paradigm that God created everything in less than 10,000 years. Now, I deal with this subject in depth in my book, A Matter of Days, the second edition. But different young Earth creationists have different ways of trying to deal with this light travel time problem. And one you mentioned is, well, astronomers really can't measure distances directly, therefore these objects aren't as far away as they claim. And this is all based on the fact that if you were to go back 20, 30 years ago, in fact, I remember taking a class on measuring the distances to stars and galaxies, and this was back in the 1960s, and they would say, well, we can only use trigonometry. The pastor in the sermon mentioned trigonometry and how he didn't really like trigonometry. I love trigonometry. So, but I started studying trigonometry when I was 7 and 8. he got it way too late. I was just talking to him saying, it's a lot more fun when you can see its applications. But what was happening in the 60s, astronomers were saying we can only use trigonometry to directly measure distances no more than about 300 light years away. And the technique is this, and probably, you know, I don't know whether you remember taking geometry in a junior high or high school, but you probably mean kind of the theorem that everybody knows is the isosceles triangle theorem. That if you know the length of the baseline and the two angles at each end of the baseline, then you can determine the distance to the vertex. Well, a baseline that astronomers use is the orbit of the Earth. And so they will measure the position of a star in the wintertime and again in the summertime. You get a baseline of 186 million miles. And they measure the angle or the position very carefully. If they see a difference in the motion of the star between summer and winter, that exists in the two angles, they can measure the distance of the star. The problem is those angles are very almost identical to one another. It's very difficult to measure those with any precision. And so a lot of young Earth creationists think we're still stuck at that level. We can only go out 300 light years, therefore there's no threat to their model. Well, astronomers today are using that same theorem of geometry, only now they use the baseline of an entire galaxy. And so what they're doing is they're looking at what are called hydrogen maser sources. And think of it as a laser at microwave wavelengths. These are very compact bodies that exist in galaxies. They're very bright and easy to see, but these are objects that are orbiting about the center of their galaxy. And so if you make measurements over, say, a 30-year period, you get the orbit of this maser source going around the center of the galaxy. Now you no longer have a baseline of 186,000 miles. You've got a baseline of about 50,000 light years. So now you got a big baseline. And moreover, they're using radio telescopes that they link together all over the planet. And what's different about, I went into radio astronomy. The reason I went into radio astronomy, at optical astronomy, when you look at light coming from stars and galaxies, all you get is the power of the light. You don't get the phase information. Our atmosphere just gobbles up and messes up the phase information. But at radio wavelengths, the atmosphere doesn't do that. So you get the position of the wave and the power of the wave, which means you can link together telescopes all over the world and basically make the equivalent of a telescope that's 6,000 miles in diameter. And we all know that the bigger the diameter of the telescope, the more accurately you can measure those angles. So, using direct geometry, we can now measure the distances to galaxies 470 million light years away, which means the path length is 470 million years without any assumptions, which means the light had to traverse 470 million years of space. Now, I could go into all the other arguments, but I won't because we don't have enough time. I want to get to some of the other questions. If you want responses to all the other young Earth attempts, or if somebody wants to ask a specific one, I'll be more than happy. If Keith Wilson wants to come back and say, Hugh, I don't want that one, I want this one, I'll deal with it. But they are dealt with in the book, A Matter of Days, the second edition.
So I have a question. I'm not a biologist and don't really have any training.
But you are a guy who's worked on long baseline interferometry.
That's right. I know that.
So you know all about this argument.
That's my field, yeah. But yeah, as far as biology and anatomy, I don't really have much training or knowledge of that. But one, as far as the human body design, one thing I always wondered since I was a kid was how annoying it was to choke on your food. And it, would it have been a better design to have where you communicate separate from where you eat and drink? So I was just wondering if you had any insight or thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, there's a variety of ways that skeptics have brought up that argument. I mean, like we have organs that work for urination and sex at the same time. Couldn't we have had separate functions and separate organs to make that work? And yeah, every time I drink a little sip of water, it goes down the wrong way. I'm choking and coughing for about 10 minutes. So I said, you know, why couldn't have God done it differently? But then I realized, you know, God could have created our body in such a way that we have separate organs for these different functions, but now we would need a bigger body to make that work. And there's problems with having a bigger body. You know, God wanted us to be bipedal so we could have use of our arms and hands. But the problem with being bipedal is the taller or the bigger the human body is that the bone weight you need to support the body goes up with the square of the height. And so if you're 7 feet tall, you have to have a bone mass that's about double someone who's 5 feet tall. And that means you need a lot more muscle to make that thing work. It takes a lot more energy to get that body to work. And when you fall, you're going to do more damage to yourself. And you can see this in the National Basketball Association. The really tall basketball players get injured all the time because when they fall, the law of gravity means that they do a little more damage. And so if you fall from 6 feet, you're going to hurt yourself a lot more than if you fall from 2 feet, which is why little children, they fall all the time and they get right up and they're fine because they're so small that the law of gravity doesn't do them a lot of damage. But when they get to be teenagers and they fall, now they can hurt themselves. And sometimes that explains why you got to take your teenage tall sons to the ER frequently, and you don't have to do that when they're only 8 months old. So, and that always amazed me when I had my sons. It's like, gee, they're really hurting themselves, but they just snap right back up. Gravity doesn't do much. So that's really the problem. You can solve the problem, but you got to do it with a bigger body. Bigger body means you need more energy, which means you need to consume more food. And the bigger your body, the less efficiently it deals with the food. Hey, you're tall enough to realize that, hey, it's a little bit tough to be over 6 feet tall. And what you really see this in the annals of Julius Caesar. I had to take Latin when I was in high school, so they basically had us read Julius Caesar's works. That's how we learned our Latin. But if you read about the campaigns of Julius Caesar, he describes how he was able to go into what is now Switzerland. And Switzerland at that time had an army of 70,000 trained soldiers. Their average height was 7 feet. Okay, here's Julius Caesar, and he had 50,000 soldiers. And he invaded Switzerland and conquered this army of 70,000 7-foot-tall people. What was the average height of the soldiers in Julius Caesar's army? 5 feet tall. So these 5-footers beat the 7-footers. But mainly because they could march all day. So, you know, the Romans had built these roads. And these 5-footers could carry 100 pounds on their back and march 50 miles a day. If you're 7 feet tall, you can't do that. But you can if you're 5 feet tall. So you can read the stories of Julius Caesar, and he explains why he was glad he didn't have soldiers that were 7 feet tall. So, however, different story with David and Goliath, because Goliath had something supernatural about him. There's no way he could be 9 feet, 9 inches tall or taller and be able to carry 250 pounds of weapons and armor into battle. Unless there's something supernatural that got past this law of physics, then, hey, the bone mass has to go up with the square of the height, and you're going to lose mobility. It tells us in the Bible that Goliath was highly mobile and a very very competent soldier. And so Goliath had to use a stone to take him down. Okay, question.
Yes, Hugh, thank you. Keith, excuse me, Doug McComb says, does the field of astrobiology contribute anything to our scientific knowledge? And is there any merit to the Drake equation that they use?
Okay, what was the first part of his question?
Does astrobiology contribute anything to our scientific knowledge?
Well, I engage astrobiologists a lot. Astrobiology is a science of life beyond planet Earth. And as I engage them, I said, the way you're advertising your discipline, your quest is to find life elsewhere in the universe. But the way you've marketed yourself, you'll only be considered a success if you find life. And so my appeal to them is this. It's just as valuable to get a no answer as to get a yes answer. Both answers are an important contribution. So I'm in favor of us investing money in astrobiology, because if the answer is there is no life beyond Earth, or there's only Earth-transported life beyond Earth, that's an important scientific deduction to make. Or we do find life. And so part of what I've written in that peer-reviewed paper I recommended is, from a biblical Christian perspective, God could create life on another planet. But if he did, it would involve the same level of fine-tuning that we see here on Earth. And so maybe God did create life elsewhere. But maybe God decided all I need is planet Earth. There's no need for me to create life elsewhere. I can do everything I want to do just with this planet Earth. A number of theologians have made the argument that God doesn't perform gratuitous miracles. He doesn't need another planet, so they predict that there won't be life elsewhere. The problem with an atheistic worldview perspective, you have to conclude that life can arise apart from God, apart from any mind. That's a very easy step, and that life can easily evolve from a microbe into human beings, and therefore life has got to be everywhere. And so from a non-theistic perspective, astrobiology is saying, we're going to prove the atheist right, that life is everywhere in the universe. But so far, astrobiology ranks as the only data-free discipline. It's the only discipline where we have no data proving that there's no life elsewhere in the universe. Although I argue the fact that it has no data actually is a point of interest. So showing that there isn't life is just as important as showing that there is. So far, everywhere we look in the universe, we see conditions that are hostile, extremely hostile to advanced life, suggesting that we really are alone. And people said, well, have you looked everywhere? No, we haven't. There are extremely distant galaxies, and we're looking at them as they were 12 billion years ago, so who knows what they look like now? So I can't say that we've exhaustively searched. On the other hand, astronomers have done a lot of searching. And I put a Facebook post up about the Vera Rubin telescope. It's going to go online. It'll become operational next year. This is a telescope that's going to give us a huge amount of search data for the universe. It'll be interesting to see what it finds. What was the second part of the question?
He was asking about the Drake equation.
The Drake equation. Well, kind of what you're going to see in this series on fine-tuning is the Drake equation has a lot more factors in it than what Frank Drake put in. By the way, when I was at the University of Toronto, I also got to take a course from Frank Drake himself, and he talked about his equation, and at that time it had seven terms in the equation, and basically saying, well, life has to be extremely abundant in the universe, and here's how we calculate the probability. Okay, maybe one star out of 10 has the conditions necessary of a planet orbiting it in which life is possible. One planet out of 10 may have the conditions necessary for life, and the origin of life may have happened on one out of 10. And you know, he said, I'm just pulling these numbers out of a hat. I'm just going to assume that the probability is 10% for each of the seven terms I have in the equation. And so 1/10 times 1/10 is 1%. 1% times 1/10 is 1/10%. And so we wind up with a probability of 10 to the minus 7 for seven terms. But then he says, there's a trillion planets in the universe, and we divide that by 10 million, we still get an enormous number of planets that have life. And one of his final terms is, okay, 10% of the planets that have life on it will have life as just as advanced as we are. But the problem with the Drake equation is, if any one of those terms has a probability of zero, what's the endpoint probability? Zero. All it takes is one factor in the equation to have a probability of zero, basically to make the point there is no life elsewhere in the universe. And the other critique, and this is now in the scientific literature, there's way more than seven terms in the equation. And so how many terms are there? What you're going to see as we go through this series, the number of terms exceeds 10,000. And so if the probability is even just 10% for each of those terms, you've got no possibility for life elsewhere. So that's the Drake equation. Frank Drake was a compatriot of Carl Sagan. You want to know where Carl got a lot of his stuff from? He got it from Frank Drake. Go ahead. By the way, I think Frank is still alive. Very old, but still alive.
Recently, we broke the record for the number of people in space. I think it was 17, just a few days ago. China launched their own space station and planned to go to the moon by 2030. You know, Elon Musk is putting, you know, money into this too. I think a lot of governments are. So you mentioned with astrobiology, it's important we get answers, specifically no's. Those are important. How much money do we put into, say, colonizing other planets until we get to an unethical point where it's like trillions of dollars? Now, we don't need a no. It's too much money. What, in your opinion, where's the stopping point?
Well, people have been talking about what they call terraforming Mars, taking Mars and transforming it so that it's got an atmosphere that we can breathe, transforming it so that it has a magnetosphere that protects it from radiation. I've seen various estimates of how much that terraforming of Mars would cost, and they're not even looking at the soil problem, so that's a whole other issue. How do you grow stuff on Martian soil? But even just getting the atmosphere right, getting a water cycle established, getting some protection from solar and cosmic radiation, the minimum price tag I've seen is $60 quadrillion. Okay, so that's a little bit more than, I mean, what the U.S. Gross national product is now $21 trillion. So we're a little bit removed from getting to that. You know, 60 quadrillion. But here's the rather bad news. You spend the 60 quadrillion, how long does that terraforming stay intact for human life to survive on the surface? It stays intact for about 60 years. So after 60 years, you got to spend another $60 quadrillion. So, and in my opinion, it's way more than 60 quadrillion. Because you haven't solved a lot of the other problems that Mars presents for us. But the big problem is, yes, we could transform it to make it warm and wet, but you still got the carbonate crisis on Mars. Any water you put there, any warmth you put there, quickly gets pulled out, put into carbonates, and the planet becomes cold and dry again. So, and I wish Elon Musk would kind of listen to that, and you'll spend the money elsewhere. Now, what is happening is that the Chinese and the Americans and others are saying, well, maybe we can establish a small colony in the moon. And so they're aware that at the south pole of the moon, there's a crater with really high walls. And you know, comets bombard the moon all the time. And comets are 85% frozen water. So they have found a crater on the moon that's got a fairly large store of frozen water. And they said, we can go there and we can mine the water. The water we can drink, we can separate the water through energy into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen we can breathe, the hydrogen we can use for fuel. So there actually is serious plans to set up a small colony on the moon. Now here's my response. Why put a colony on the moon? And they're saying, well, maybe we could do science experiments on the moon. I said, yes, I'm all for those science experiments, but we're no longer in the 1970s. We want to put an array of radio telescopes in the backside of the moon, which is a serious proposal. Have you ever heard of Starlink? I think that's another Elon Musk project. He wants to put up 100,000 satellites into Earth orbit so that they can tell where every human being is to within 1 centimeter. And incidentally, that has some really valuable economic payoff. If we can tell where every vehicle is to within 1 centimeter, we can realistically have cars and trucks and trains and buses with no drivers, basically using computers and AI to have these buses and cars and trucks drive where there'd be zero accidents, where we could have twice as much traffic flow on the freeways as you have now because you can put the vehicles closer together and you can run them at higher speeds. So that could work. But astronomers have pointed out, and by the way, it's not just Elon Musk that wants to put up tens of thousands of satellites. The Chinese want to do it too. So now we're looking at maybe 250,000 satellites around the Earth. What does that do to astronomy? Those things reflect light. And if they're sending out radio waves to the Earth to tell you where you are, that's really going to foul up radio astronomy. And so they're there's actually an article that you can see in the literature where the astronomers got together and basically said to Elon Musk and the Chinese, go ahead and put these satellites up, but we want you to fund the building of an array of telescopes in the backside of the moon. If you fund that, we're okay with you putting up all these satellites. And so they're saying, and by the way, that's within reason. It wouldn't cost that much money, given our technology, to actually put telescopes in the backside of the moon. By the way, you don't have to send a single human being. How do we know that? 17,000 feet above elevation in Chile, there's an array of millimeter wave radio telescopes. Those telescopes were placed at 17,000 feet without any human beings having to be on the surface. What did they do? They basically used a Lego block analogy. They took these telescopes, and these telescopes are 33 feet across. They're not small telescopes. But they found a way to basically make them modular. And so at 3,000 feet, they had a factory there where they're building the different components, the base, what fits on top, the drive motors, then they put the dish on top, put all the electronics in. They found a way to use helicopters basically to take these pieces of these telescopes, take them up to 17,000 feet, and basically link them together without any human contact whatsoever. Just a guy in the helicopter who's breathing oxygen so he wouldn't pass out, controlling this little device which put all these telescopes together. And we're talking several dozen telescopes were constructed that way. Guess what? We could do the same thing on the backside of the moon. We don't need to send people. And so I've written articles by making the point, if we're interested in science, there's no need to send another human being into outer space. It can all be done with machines. The Apollo program, different story. We didn't have the technology back there to do without human beings. Today we do. And by the way, the cost is 0.1% of what it costs to send human beings. So keep the people at home. They'll be healthier because even spending a week on the moon has its health consequences. So if you don't have Earth gravity anymore, there are consequences. Notice in those space stations, nobody gets up there for more than 6 months. If it's longer than 6 months, you're going to have a hard time returning to planet Earth. Yuri Gagarin tried it. He died within a year. He had lost so much bone mass, and that's the problem. If you're not subjected to Earth gravity, the body says, why am I producing all these bones? I don't need it. So it stops producing the bones. So, even if you exercise with bungee cords to simulate gravity for 4 hours a day, this experiment has been done, the astronauts lose 1% of their bone mass per month. And that bone mass never comes back. You come back to Earth, it won't come back. So losing 6% of your bone mass is one thing. Losing 10% is catastrophic. So keep the astronauts at home, send the machines.
Thank you, Hugh. We have an online question. SlamRN wants to know if you've seen the recent James Tour, Dave Farina debate on the state of origin of life research.
I've not seen the debate. I've heard of it, but I haven't had time to look at it. My board at the Reasons to Believe is really keeping me way too busy, but I do intend to look at it. I've known Jim for over 30 years, and he actually writes and consults us quite frequently about the origin of life. He himself is a nanotechnologist, So very familiar with these complex molecules, but he recognizes that the origin of life discipline is multidisciplinary. So we're in communication, but I've not seen the debate.
Doug's question about the Drake question reminded me, the Drake equation reminded me. Are you familiar with a website called Information is Beautiful?
I'm not familiar with that website. Okay. I don't deny the claim.
Right. That's the website. And then there's it's broken into dozens and dozens of very interesting infographics. You know, the flow of money across international boundaries and just all kinds of very interesting things. One of them that caught my interest many years ago was the probability of life in the universe, of other civilizations in the universe. And so that's where the Drake equation comes in. And you can play with sliders on the probability of various parameters. Well, if you slam them all the way to the least likely scenario, it still comes up with, I don't know, four or five other civilizations in the known universe. And I wondered if you might have a criticism of that.
Well, when I was taking that class from Frank Drake, I remember talking to the professors and graduate students there saying, he uses a 10% probability for the origin of life on any planet. We know from lab experiments that the probability is way smaller than 10%. If you just have random chemicals on a planet, those chemicals will come together and make a living life form. And that probability, independent of divine intervention, could well be zero. We have no scientific evidence that is anything different than zero. And so if it's zero, there goes the Drake equation. But yeah, when I took the course from him, he went through all these numbers, basically assigned a 10% probability to all the terms, and said at a minimum, there's 10,000 advanced civilizations within the nearby galaxies. And he says, they're bound to be trying to communicate with us. It's worth spending a lot of money. But his conclusion that there's 10,000 is based on the assumption that none of the probabilities in his Drake equation were smaller than 10% probability. And I remember telling my fellow graduate students, there's no way the origin of life is as high as 10%. It's got to be way below 10%. So, and that's just one of multiple terms. I mean, one thing we're going to be doing this class is looking at our star, the sun. We've looked at tens of millions of stars that we can measure with some precision, and none of them, except for the sun, has the characteristics that are needed for advanced life. Frank Drake put 10% probability there, and so the numbers are way below that. So you don't wind up with 10,000. And by the way, what Frank never talked about is the fact that it takes time for an intelligent civilization, even in the most optimistic scenario, to show up. Papers have been published in the scientific literature basically making the point it can't happen in less than 13.8 billion years. We have to be the first. So they're basically arguing maybe after us, but not before us. So in that sense, we have to be alone. And also they point out all these other stars and planets and galaxies we look at, we're looking at them as they were in the past. We're looking at them as they were before the minimum time for advanced life can possibly make that happen. So on that basis alone, again, you get a zero. There's lots of reasons why, apart from God, the answer to the Drake equation is zero. I just gave you two examples. There are many more.
Hugh, we have one last question. I want to say we had a lot of really good questions online, and I can't do them all. So to Tonette, please come back next week, and we'll get yours up at the top of the list. Craig McMahon says, though, many galaxies are flattened in one direction, or in one dimension. I have the impression that the dark matter halos of galaxies seem to be characterized as globular, however. If that's so, why?
Okay, good question. And yes, when you look, not all galaxies are disk-shaped. 6% of the galaxies that exist in the universe today are what we call disk or spiral galaxies, which basically look like a flattened disk. The vast majority of galaxies are spherical or ellipsoidal, so they're not disk-shaped. Some of them are irregular, where they just have pieces going everywhere. It's quite rare for a galaxy to be disk-shaped. Although in the early universe that the James Webb Space Telescope was looking at, you have a much higher percentage of disk galaxies, even as high as about 2/3 of the galaxies being spiral galaxies. And yes, as the universe gets older and older, more and more spiral galaxies collapse in a spheroidal or an ellipsoidal shape. But around all galaxies are these big exotic dark matter halos. And these halos are typically slightly flattened, but not by much. They basically look spheroidal, kind of a slightly flattened spheroid. And that's actually necessary in order to have stable, symmetrical spiral arms that stay stable and symmetrical for billions of years, which is what you need for advanced light to be possible. But different galaxies have different amounts of dark matter. One of the things we're going to see about our Milky Way galaxy, it has an enormous dark matter halo, bigger than anything we see anywhere else. So just to give you an idea, the spiral disk structure has a diameter of about 100,000 light years. The dark matter halo in which that disk galaxy is embedded extends 1.9 million light years. So our dark matter halo goes almost halfway to the Andromeda galaxy. So 90% of the mass of our Milky Way galaxy is its dark matter halo. And it's because we have such a huge dark matter halo that's so massive that our Milky Way galaxy is different from any other spiral galaxy we look at. We'll get there. And if you want the technical details, I think it's chapter 8, of Design to the Core, where we get into the dark matter halo of our Milky Way galaxy and why that has to be fine-tuned to have advanced life. So that's part of the fine-tuning argument.
Hugh, thank you as always so much. Let's give a hand to Dr. Ross.
Thank you.
Would you please close us in a word of prayer?
That'd be my privilege. Father in heaven, I want to thank you, Lord, for the technology we have today, that people can be part of this class here in Sierra Madre, but also all over the world. And thank you for the different perspectives we get from people that participate from around the world. And Father, I pray that we would take what we've been learning from this series and what we've been learning from people asking questions, that we'd be able to use what you've given us, Lord, as tools to share with other people, that we can see many come to know you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. So help us, Father, as we lead this class, to continue to be open in our hearts to receive more of your light, love, and truth. Thank you for giving us the privilege of living in the 21st century, and may we use that privilege for your purpose and your glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.